Hi, I'm James Esposito, and this is New Books in History. I just finished speaking with David Edgerton about his new book, The Rise and Fall of the British Nation, A 20th Century History. This book was released by Allen Lane in June 2018. The United Kingdom is often supposed to be unique in its aversion to nationalism as an ideology, but also as policy. Edgerton explores an alternative view of British experience in the 20th century, with a new history that shows the creation of a specific British nation and its fall as a story of power and change in the vein of continental powers like Germany or the Soviet Union. Along the way, Edgerton examines British capitalism, militarism in the state, as well as conflicting ideas of political economy. The United Kingdom's unique position as a liberal, capitalist, and global power at the beginning of the century shifts towards a new socioeconomics of national development through the experience of total war. Britain is rebuilt after 1945 as a distinctive economic, political, and social unit within national borders. Britain's nationalist project reaches its height in the 1960s, with a political culture dedicated to domestic economic development as well as industrial productivism. Far from repeating old narratives of the creation of a post-war welfare state, Keynesianism, or a managed decline, Edgerton shows us a vision of a country that is post-imperial, nationalistic, militaristic, and highly confident in its talent in science and technology. Britain leaves in the 1970s in economic as well as political turmoil. The nation is reformed again towards a liberal, globalist orientation by the Thatcher government. It increasingly integrates itself into the European and global economy. Barriers to trade break down, and the nation as a coherent economic unit ends as the United Kingdom becomes a financial center, largely for the capital of others. Along with economic change, the return of subnational politics in Scotland and in Wales emerged to challenge the authority of the state. Edgerton's book challenges the reader to rethink their assumptions about what Britishness is by uncovering hidden materiality embedded within the British nation, as well as the hidden role of capitalists, ideologues, and the military, long marginalized by earlier historical accounts. It was a pleasure to talk to David, and I hope you enjoy the show. David, welcome to the show.
Hi, delighted to be on.
Before we dive into the book, could you tell us a little bit about yourself? What made you want to become a historian?
Well, I'm rather an unusual historian. I didn't study history at school beyond the age of 15, and I didn't study history as an undergraduate either, except informally. So my decision to become a historian came rather later in life than it did for most people who write history books. And it was driven, I suppose, always by a concern with current affairs, with politics. And I gave myself, I suppose, a pretty eclectic education as a historian.
Okay, so did you study journalism or like international relations when you were doing your undergraduate degree, or did you just have something else that you
studied chemistry, in fact.
Okay.
In a place, Oxford, at a time when one could spend most of one's time, out of the lab, out of the lecture room, reading, essentially.
Okay. Yeah. No. That's really interesting. A lot of the science and technology historians I've worked with, either as mentors or as friends, are chemists by training, which is interesting. How did this particular book come about? We had talked earlier that it has many of the same aspects of your previous work, but it is also sort of larger, more all-encompassing work in itself.
Well, the simple answer is that my publisher asked me whether I wanted to write a history of 20th century Britain, and I jumped at the chance because the history of the nation is a standard form which appeals to many people. And I thought it would be a good vehicle for putting forward the ideas that you mentioned that appear in previous books, and to put them forward both to a broader academic audience and also a broader public audience as well.
Yeah, in the introduction, you make a note, just sort of a brief note, saying that like historians should try, at least to attempt to write sort of towards international affairs and towards sort of political life in their nation to sort of reassess it. This book is sort of a reassessment of a lot of the sort of
you know, hackney tropes of British modern Britain, British history.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, another reason for writing it is that I felt for a long time a certain dissatisfaction with the general treatments of 20th century British history, both in the form of textbooks, but also in the form of university and school curricula. So there was something I wanted to say, as it were, against standard understandings that had to be said at the level of the national history over a century.
Sure, sure. There is a huge business in sort of, you know, like the culture industry and sort of, you know, rehashing these sort of familiar, you know, familiar themes and familiar ideas of what Britain is and who the British are and what their place in sort of world history is.
Exactly. And you know, repetition gives arguments authority. Mm-hmm. But I think post-Brexit, things have both got worse and got better. In that a lot of arguments that have been made about the nature of the British experience in the recent past have been shown, at least for many people's arguments, have been shown to be wrong. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, certain perhaps submerged kinds of histories have come to the surface as arguments for leaving the European Union. Now, on the left, I think there's a tendency to think that what's come to the surface is a horrible imperialism. That Brexit is the latest manifestation of a deep-seated imperialism. But I think that's wrong. Actually, I think what's resurfaced is a certain global liberalism. The notion of a global Britain, a Britain trading with the whole world, open to the whole world, you know, radical free trading. Mm. And you can see that in many of the statements of the Brexiteers.
Sure.
So history is British. The standard British history has begun to seem inadequate in the light of Brexit.
Just sort of talking about the Brexit angle. A lot of this book, and I think this is, you do a fantastic job with this, is trying to get to the material and how the nation in your mind comes mid-century as a sort of material, not revolution, but a sort of material development and developmental economics. A lot of British historians sort of, you know, those sorts of ideas are other places. You know, they might be sort of confined to Central Europe or the developing world. But you really sort of bring it home and sort of talk about big industrial conglomerates like Imperial Chemical Industries and these sort of other incredibly technical but also sort of incredibly intensive and large national efforts to industrialize and become more self-sufficient.
Yeah, that's right. If you're writing about the Soviet Union or Germany or India, you would write about dams and rivers and great new power stations and chemical companies and autarky and all these things. But when we come to Britain, no. We've had a very abstract economic history of the United Kingdom. And indeed, a sense that these big things like dams and great chemical combines were to be found in other places, but not in the United Kingdom, and that was precisely the problem. So, yes, I did want to write a material history, a really material history of what every British person would have known in the past. And every British person knew the significance of coal to the British economy or of shipping. Would have known the names of great enterprises like Imperial Chemical Industries. It's just that we've forgotten all that, and we've forgotten, even as cultural historians, that that was how people understood the world and Britain's place in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so many of the towns in the north, but also you know, in the south as well, are you know factory towns or shipbuilding towns, like Birkenhead outside Liverpool is this massive shipyards that made, you know, military weapons and shipping, but also commercial shipping that was very important to the British economy.
Yes, absolutely. And it's a very peculiar thing, the extent to which modern history has moved away from the material, has come back in something called studies of material culture. Mm-hmm. But material culture is more culture than material.
Sure.
So I think there is room for for taking material history, perhaps even materialist history, seriously once again. And again, I think Brexit helps here. Suddenly, questions of trade, of tariffs, of non-tariff barriers, of regulations, all become the stuff of daily political discourse.
Sure. And we can get back into that towards the end of the show, where we talk about, you know, the year 2000 and what the sort of future holds, or our contemporary world kind of holds here. But interestingly, you start the book with a discussion of political history of the turn of the century and the importance of what conservatives and liberals believed, which something you didn't do that in some of your other work. Did that sort of come out organically, or was that something that you wanted to work on before?
Well, I've always been interested in political economic ideas, and I certainly have always wanted to expand my knowledge of that area. But it struck me that I wanted to put politics and political economy right up front in the book, because I want to argue that these forms of understanding have been profoundly influential in shaping our more general understanding of the British experience in the 20th century. And that some of these political economies and the power, the imaginative power of these political economies has been rather lost over the course of time, certainly rather lost in much of the historiography.
Yeah.
So I wanted really to as other historians have done, to bring to the fore the range of ideas that underlay British liberalism. Is globality, it's anti-imperialism, indeed it's anti-nationalism as well. Mm-hmm. And to contrast that with what I take to be the great opposition to that liberal program in the first third of the 20th century, which is an imperialist program. So these programs are in contention in the first half of the century. That's a rather different approach to the older political histories, which essentially take conservatism and imperialism to be broadly simply reactionary, and the progressive forces in the British case were first the Liberal Party, and then certainly by the interwar years the Labour Party. So it's a very liberal, Labour focused account. I want to stress, for example, that into the early 1930s. Labour is a free trading party. That's absolutely central to its ideology and its attractiveness to many intellectuals in particular. So putting political economy in, and putting both liberal and imperialist political economy in right at the beginning is indicative of a broader rethinking of the history of British politics.
Yeah, sure. No, I really like that part. And you also talk about, you know, the conservatives are an imperialist party, but also they have these sort of semi-autarkic / imperial economics in their platform and what they believe. And that's usually sort of not talked about in that way, for sure. In the beginning of the book, in the introduction, you talk about how much of your book is an exploration of the right and what they believe, but also what British capitalists, who they are, where they are, and what they believe, which is, I think, a great approach to your work. Did those ideas sort of come out of Brexit, or were you sort of interested in sort of right-wing thinking or conservative thinking, you know, going into the project?
Oh, yes. No. This is really nothing to do with Brexit. These ideas have been important to me for a long time. But I've been able to, as it were, think about them in a much broader, more general frame in the writing of this book. In my Warfare State book, for example, I developed the thesis that the state, the conservative state, was technically creative, and that liberals on the left haven't been able to see that. And in this book, I make a very general claim for the creativity of the right, that they need to be seen as originators of new and important ideas. The Conservative Party is the originator of new policies which are put into practice, not merely a responder to the rise of the welfare state. And similarly, British capitalists have been hugely creative in coming forward with new machines, new products, new kinds of politics. Indeed, I think one of the things that most surprised me in the course of my research was the extent to which the British House of Commons and the British House of Lords before 1945 were dominated by business people.
Mm-hmm.
And extraordinarily, that's been written out of the historiography. Even in the case of Stanley Baldwin, the Prime Minister, who is the managing director of one of the largest steelworks in steelmaking companies, not simply a single factory, steelmaking companies in Europe. I mean, he's not quite Krupp or Thyssen, but he is a major, major industrialist who happens to be British Prime Minister as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really cool thing that sort of gets lost. Certainly, I didn't, I've read a lot of British historiography and I've never really thought about who these capitalists are, what are they doing, and how productive they are, and what they're, what they're investing in. You make pains in this book to sort of focus on this sort of false dichotomy between the City of London and financial interests that have, either interests in, British colonies or British trading partners like Argentina. And sort of the northern industrial base, and how, a long time the left sort of said, oh, well, the reason why we're in this sort of industrial decline is because we're too focused, or our capitalists are too focused on externalities and not focused on what's going on here.
Yes. One of the core arguments of the book, I don't make it particularly explicit, this is a book, at least in part, for the general public, is an argument with the dominant left traditions of understanding of 20th century Britain. And that tradition holds that British capitalism is peculiar in its global and especially imperial orientation, that it's financial rather than industrial, that this global orientation has led to the weakening of British domestic capitalism, which has led to inevitably to a general economic decline. So I take this as to be the most interesting general thesis there has been about 20th century British history. It's associated with Tom Nairn, Perry Anderson, Peter Kane, and Tony Hopkins, Eric Hobsbawm, many, many, many others have advanced arguments of this sort. And I show that while it is the case that British capitalism was indeed peculiarly global, this did not mean it was essentially financial. It was global in a very material way as well. There were British factories, British farms, British mines, British utilities all over the world. And of course, they were connected to Britain by ships. Again, a very non-financial form of capitalism. On top of that, there was in fact a great national moment of industrial investment, of national economic development, contrary to the thesis of this left, which argued that was never possible and did happen.
Sure. Yeah. No.
So my argument is actually, look, it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
So the thesis is kind of doubly wrong. It's wrong in that it misconstrues the nature of British global capitalism, and it's also wrong in that it denies what actually happened in the United Kingdom, that for a time anyway, a genuinely national industrial capitalism flourished.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So getting towards the 1950s, if we can go there to talk about how in your mind do you identify sort of the British nation as you construct it? You talk about how from the 1960s to the 1980s, there is this time where the state directs through planning, but also through nationalization and other import controls and sort of other macroeconomic efforts to develop the industrial base of the country.
Exactly. So the usual characterization is of a post-war state that is, quotes, Keynesian and a welfare state, and that it therefore, in this argument, fails to intervene industrially to develop modern industry. My argument is that we have overemphasized Keynesianism, and welfare. And we should look at a kind of post-war productionism, if you like, that is a national productivism that is shared by both left and right. Mm-hmm. And that national productivism is really very different from what had gone before, in that before the mid-1940s, and especially before 1914, the British government was to a very great degree indifferent as to where manufacturers or food or whatever it might be came from. The Britishness of material in circulation within the British economy was not really an issue. But it really did become a central issue for politics after 1945. So we get a push for self-sufficiency in food, attempts to do the same for energy through nuclear power. More generally, a deep commitment to the development of national industry as opposed to being an importing nation. Now, why do I describe this as the broader context as being the creation of the British nation? Well, because I argue that before roughly 1945, it's hard to argue that there is something called the British nation which has economic as well as political boundaries for two reasons. One is the centrality of free trade to British economic thinking, but the other is empire. Mm-hmm. For many people, though not everybody, the central political unit for the British was the empire. Mm-hmm. It was the empire that was at war in the Great War and in the Second World War. It was the empire that had a capital city in London and a second city in Glasgow. So the empire was central to imagining the space in which British people and perhaps their dependent peoples lived in as well. Mm-hmm. Now that goes, seems to me, after 1945. There's a very strong sense of the United Kingdom. I mean, it's not usually called the United Kingdom, mm-hmm. except by the military and diplomats. It's called Britain.
Yeah.
It becomes the term to describe the nation. Now, there is some ambiguity as to whether Britain means the United Kingdom as a whole, whether it includes Northern Ireland or not. But I use the term British nation to encompass the formal territory of the United Kingdom to make the point that that really is an economic unit, especially after 1945, and indeed a single political unit to a considerable, though not total degree. And that's different from what went before and is different from what was to come later as well. But the very idea that the United Kingdom should have a well-developed economic nationalism, or indeed a political nationalism, is a surprising one for most people, because the usual argument has been that the British elite has been too liberal or too imperial in its approach to the economy, and therefore has not developed the necessary nationalism to develop the national economy. And politically and culturally, we haven't had British nationalism because we're still stuck in the empire.
Mm-hmm.
So imperialism stands for nationalism. At least there's a conflation of imperialism and nationalism. And I want to suggest that there is a very important, well, there is often a conflation, to be sure, but there is an analytical and political distinction between imperialism and nationalism that it is vitally important to grasp.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the things that you talk about, sort of getting back to the material aspect, is that after 1945, there is this enormous push to make Britain much more agriculturally independent from the rest of the world. You know, when you think about the time of the Great War, but also the Second World War, there was real threat of Britain starving to death, or at least starving to, you know, some sort of unfavorable conclusion to total war. Can you just talk about, like, how that was sort of designed to make Britain more independent, but also more national, and what the discourses of food are.
Yes, I mean, food is critical. I mean, food is the great import into the United Kingdom, and the United Kingdom was seen as being radically different from continental Europe, precisely because it was not self-sufficient in food. And this was seen as a very great advantage. You could buy the best food from where it was cheapest. And as a result, the British people, it was claimed, were much better fed than the people of continental Europe. As you say, the sea lanes to Britain could be interrupted by enemy navies, and that indeed happened in two world wars. However, the extent to which in those wars the United Kingdom actually resorted to national supply of food has been rather exaggerated. Mm-hmm. So even in the Second World War, overseas supply of food was absolutely essential. But politically, there was a very great change. There was a move after 1945 towards at least increasing very significantly the amount of food to be locally grown, which implied a radical pulling back from interaction with the world economy. Given the centrality of food imports, so we end up with a situation that by the 1970s, 1980s, the United Kingdom is nearly self-sufficient in food for the first time since the mid 19th century. It would have been really extraordinary for an Edwardian, or indeed somebody even in the 1950s, to imagine a future where the United Kingdom exported wheat or exported beef. I mean, the United Kingdom was built in the early 20th century as the place which imported both those commodities. So it is a radical transformation in the material basis of British life.
And one of the cool things in this book is you see, you know, the development of new national industries, or the expansion of things like the chemical industry, where Britain is seriously looking at coal to oil and these sort of rather elaborate chemical solutions, domestic semi-autarkic solutions to problems. But also you can kind of see in the mid-century is the chemical industry feeds into the food industry. You have a well-developed chemical industry with, you know, fertilizers and pesticides, and that gets, you know, a national food industry as well. You know, you develop both at the same time.
Yes, absolutely. The agriculture is also chemistry. It's also motor manufacturing. It's also pharmaceuticals, effectively. So it's a very modern sector. In fact, it has the fastest rising levels of labour productivity of any sector of the economy after the war. So to regard it as being backward in any way would be a mistake. But going back to the oil from coal, what's really interesting about those programmes in the 1930s is they're essentially rejected. There is a kind of genuine liberalism still at work there, where people say that it's always going to be cheaper to import oil. Mm-hmm. And to have a navy to defend the tankers importing it than to make oil locally from local coal. But that kind of thinking becomes much, much weaker after the Second World War.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you just elaborate a little bit about energy? Because energy in the form of coal and oil, but also sort of later as a byproduct of the weapons industry, of nuclear weapons, is also a major objective of the British state.
Exactly. I mean, we perhaps underplay the significance of the British military nuclear program, which was, in fact, a very early one. It was probably the largest in the world in 1940-41. We also tend to forget that in the 1950s, the United Kingdom, and not the Soviet Union or the USA, had the most ambitious nuclear electricity program in the world. Mm-hmm. It's really quite extraordinary. And indeed, up into the early 70s, the United Kingdom is actually generating more nuclear electricity than any other country. Now, that changes very radically after that. But it gives one a measure of the ambition of the British state compared to other states to go nuclear, essentially, and to become autonomous in, to make major strides towards autonomy in energy supply.
Yeah, I think this might be a good time to talk about the military and talk about the warfare state as being sort of the primary focus of Britain, at least in the 1950s and through the 60s, and what that shape is and how that sort of differs from more familiar accounts of the welfare state.
At the core of most university curricula on 20th century Britain is essentially the idea of the rise of something called the welfare state. It begins with the liberals in the Edwardian period, is brought to fruition by Labour in 1945, is at the core of the post-war settlement or social democratic post-war Britain or the post-war consensus, and it then withers away under Thatcherism or neoliberalism. From the late 1970s. Now, if one actually looks at what the British state is doing, one gets a very different picture. Certainly in the first half of the century, simply because of the importance of the two world wars, military expenditure is very much larger than welfare expenditure, as one would expect. The difficulty is that obvious fact is not taken into account when thinking about the nature of the British state or indeed the nature of British politics. So one of the things I've done, especially in my book, Warfare State, is to take that, what I call warfare state, seriously. Mm-hmm. As a set of armed services, and three by the interwar years, some ministries concerned with the supply of armaments in particular historical periods, a particular ideology of war fighting as well. And as a result of that, to rethink both the world wars, not as the civilianization of war, but the militarization of society. So the warfare state extends its reach into the British economy and British society, which gives one a very different picture to the essentially social democratic picture of war as the kind of locomotive of social advance via the Liberal Party and the Labour Party. So war is essentially a conservative force, if you like, mm-hmm. An extension of conservative but also creative forces.
Yeah.
And that one allows one to rethink the nature of the civil service, the nature of the expertise within the British state, as well as to rebalance the picture of the British state away from the welfare state. Now, of course, I'm not saying that there was no welfare state. In fact, in the book, I point to the importance of the interwar welfare state, and thereby play down the significance, at least in some dimensions, of what the Labour Party did after 1945. But in the context of post-war, I stress that the 1970s are the really interesting period for the British welfare state. This is when it begins to become a generous welfare state. This is when it becomes a really big item in the national budget. Though in fact, it is bigger today than it was then. It's reverted to being a much less generous welfare state by British historical standards and indeed by international standards too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you make a point to sort of focus on the idea that what happened post-1945 in the election of Attlee's government, a lot of what was going on was consolidating what had happened before in pensions and in healthcare and sort of putting it under a national naming or national branding to sort of forge this new nation. But in terms of what money is being spent and the resources that are given to these projects, they're not nearly as large as sort of military expenses.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think the key thing that happens under Labour is that a very, very well-developed welfare state for the working class becomes a welfare state for the whole nation. So you go from, say, 80% of the population to 90% of the population, perhaps 100 in some cases, like health. So it is an important change that's going on at the level of reach of the social services, but there's also a very important change in the way these social services are supplied. They're supplied now almost universally by the state itself. So we have nationalized hospitals supplying healthcare, though private general practice still. We have a fully state-led national insurance system. It doesn't rely on private administrators, if you like, of a national system. So the role of the state does become much, much more significant, and the role of the nation as opposed to class also becomes very important. So yes, the rise of the welfare state, I think, can be understood in fresh ways once one takes the post-war national framing seriously. And certainly one needs to move away from the view that there was essentially no welfare before 1945. That would be quite, quite wrong.
Yeah, I mean, also the sort of, there's the logical paradox with that is that how could you run a modern capitalist economy without some sort of welfare system? I mean, you could, but it would be incredibly disruptive. And due to like all the British experience with total war and these sort of straining forces involved, it seems unlikely that there would be, you know, a very, very, you know, kind of Dickensian system in place.
Well, that's right. And one reason that Britain got through the Great Depression with so little in the way of political trauma is partly due, I think, to the fact that there was a system of unemployment support for essentially anyone who was unemployed. So the safety net was there, and it was vital to the survival of British capitalism. Absolutely.
If we could just change gears a little bit and talk about technology and Britain's, as a nation's, obsession with high tech. And if you talk a lot about how there's these sort of public intellectuals that say, well, you know, Britain was not, you know, giving enough resources to high tech development and it was not a technically or scientifically minded state, if not nation itself. And how these ideas are not right at all. You know, they spent quite a bit of resources, maybe too much in some cases, on high tech, highly technological things in military, but also civil development.
Yes, absolutely. After 1945, the investment in the nuclear field, in aerospace, in electronics, and lots of civil fields was just extraordinary. Yet that was accompanied by the most influential public intellectuals claiming that the United Kingdom was peculiarly averse, or its elite was peculiarly averse to investment in science and technology. So it's an astonishing contradiction, which was at the heart of serious misunderstandings about the place of science and technology in modern British history.
Yeah, you talk about how by the 1970s the state is almost over leveraged in these high tech, almost vanity projects like Concord or the advanced gas reactor, these sorts of developmental projects. And you have this great quote where you say, like, the British almost overvalued their own inventiveness.
Oh, I think so. I think that the cult of British inventiveness went completely loopy after the Second World War. So British people simply believed that the jet engine, television, radar, goodness knows what else, was invented only by British people. These were great gifts that the British had given to the world and had not been properly recompensed for. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it was a really an extraordinary a moment of both self-aggrandizement and self-abasement at the same time, because the idea was that the United Kingdom had not properly exploited these great inventions. So in fact, it had, if anything, over-exploited them.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and there's this point by the late 70s where it's fairly clear that despite these investments, it's not giving you the rate of return on your economy. So you can develop Concorde and have the first supersonic jet airliner, but that's not going to generate the predicted sort of knock-on economic effects.
Well, that's right, and that's clear to all the experts by the late 1960s. Something is going very, very wrong. These investments aren't really worthwhile. But it takes a very long time for the for policy to change, and it's only really the 1980s that there really is a policy of no more Concords, though some slip through, and that's part of a radical denationalization of the economy. So we now have foreign cars, foreign television sets, foreign everything when it comes to manufacturers. Something which would have been unthinkable in 1940s, 50s, 60s, and even early 70s. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about a very radical material change in the United Kingdom from the 1970s onwards. That's, again, I think not been sufficiently recognised. It's not enough to say we've had deindustrialisation, which we have had. And nor I think is globalization enough. It has involved really a very serious rethinking of the role of the state in the economy.
What do you think brings this about? In the book, you do talk about culture and society. There's this sort of crisis of credibility in British governments by the late 1970s, where the high mark was the 50s. By the 1970s, all these sort of very public scandals, but also threats like terrorism in Northern Ireland that really putting a stress on what the state can do and is the state telling the truth? And, do we want the state to have all these resources that appear to be being thrown towards unproductive ventures?
Yeah, there is a crisis, and both the left and the right are attacking the state in very different ways. It's difficult to understand exactly where all these critiques came from. It's very easy to be cliched about it and point to the rise of the new right and the new left. But I think in part we have amongst the British elite a return to free trade. Mm-hmm. And that first involves going into the common market, it was called the European Economic Community. And it's important to remember that the Conservative Party asked to be let into the EEC in 1961. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's 16 years after the end of the Second World War, before decolonization has finished, at a time when the British economy is the most efficient in Europe. Now, why are they doing this? Well, it's because they believe in free trade, and they couldn't get global free trade. Mm-hmm. They couldn't get the European free trade area that they wanted, so they go into the best free trade arrangement that they can find. And that is membership of the EEC. Now they're blocked, but going into the EEC becomes the great program of the Conservative Party. The European common market is a work in progress, and it's not till the 1990s that we get the single European market, which makes a major difference to the tradability of goods and services across the now European Union. So that's a very important factor, this drive to economic liberalism within Europe, and that carries with it a critique of nationalist and national British industrial endeavours and British technological endeavours as well.
Mm-hmm. You talk about also the situation in the late 1970s, early 1980s, this scope of unemployment and sort of economic upheaval is similar to the 1930s, similar to the Great Depression. But unlike the Great Depression, there was no alternative model that was viable. You know, you couldn't copy the Soviet Union, you couldn't copy, you know, sort of totalitarian Germany or some other experiment.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's very striking that the left in the early 1980s compared that period to the 1930s, and indeed for a very short period looked to economic planning as well as Keynesianism as roots out of the Depression, and certainly they argued that Thatcher and Thatcherism were essentially a return to the cold-hearted, ignorant economics of the 1920s. But that didn't last very long. The left project really disintegrated very, very, very quickly. And within a very few years, the left had essentially adopted the political economy of the right. So rather than diminish the legitimacy of economic liberalism, the great, as it had done most certainly in the 1930s, the Great Depression of the early 80s reinforced the legitimacy. So that in effect, the blame for much of the crisis was pushed onto labor, was pushed onto the interventionist state, and that was very, very significant. So we'd say it turned out that a different kind of economics was possible, and it also turned out that you could live with many millions of unemployed for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Something which, again, people would have thought was unthinkable in the 1960s or even into the early 1970s.
How does Mrs. Thatcher sort of employ aspects of the developmental state to further her political program, of privatization, and sort of, you know, freer trade and less public investment?
Yes, I mean, the usual argument, of course, is that the Thatcher government uses the market to achieve its aims. One argument that I make is that, in fact, it uses the state to a very great extent to achieve its aims, including in the case of nationalized industries. One would have thought, if one believed in the free market, that one would privatize loss-making industries, state industries, in order to turn them into profitable private industries. But that's not, in fact, what the government did. They took state industries by the scruff of the neck and made them profitable in the public sector. Mm-hmm. And only once they were profitable were they privatized. And there are other examples of this kind of approach, education being a very, very good one. There was a radical centralization of education under central state. It came to be effectively under central state control. The British government introduced a national curriculum, something which would have been regarded as the worst sort of continental despotism in the first half of the 20th century. Yet there it was under an economically liberal government. Mm-hmm. So Thatcherism was always about using the state. It seemed to me, although of course its ideology was a profoundly anti-state ideology, and it did lead in time to the diminution of the role of the state, the radical diminution of the role of the state in certain areas, in housing, for example. it's a cause of the current housing crisis that we are living through. But in other areas, the role of the state increased. So expenditures on social welfare were either stable or increasing. So we now have, after years of Thatcherism and quote neoliberalism, more being spent in both absolute and relative terms on welfare than ever before in British history.
It's also there are all these paradoxes. But by the time you get to the 1980s, where the British state sort of develops the food production, but also energy, so North Sea oil and nuclear energy, and to a lesser extent, sort of privatized coal, in order to overcome the need to import manufacturers. So it is this weird stepping down of sort of advanced productivist economic model.
Yes, I mean, I don't think there's any intention of getting rid of the need to import manufacturers. To export manufacturers in order to import other things. There was certainly a drive to decrease imports, however. Now, not all these resulted as a consequence of state action. In the case of oil, there was a very significant private sector involvement that you didn't see in other energy sectors. But the overall effect is that by the mid-1980s, the UK need import very little food and is a net exporter of energy once more. And that means that it no longer needs a surplus of a balance of trade in manufacturers in order to import. And in fact, both the export and import of manufacturers both increase. So what you have is a denationalized system of manufacturing production. That's the really big difference that emerges. But there is this very particular conjuncture where the British state is in the extraordinarily fortunate position that it doesn't have a balance of payments problem. And that is fundamental to understanding what the Thatcher government could do and indeed did. It could be indifferent to net manufacturing exports in a way that a conservative government of the 1960s simply could not be.
Yeah, it ceases being a valid metric of economic performance and national power.
Absolutely. So manufacturing, the balance of payments itself, ceases to be a measure of national virility. It is a very, very important change in how the economy is discussed. The economy is now a question of stock market prices and entrepreneurs, not the balance of payments and investment and GDP growth even.
Oh, we mentioned this at the beginning of the podcast, talking about how by the 1980s, labor didn't have a valid alternative model. And at the end of your book, you talk about how new labor is basically that. It's the lack of an alternative to Thatcherism. Can you talk about how that came about and what that really meant for Britain at the turn of the 21st century?
Let me put a slightly different nuance on what I said earlier. Although it did turn out that the left's ideas were pushed to one side, the early late 70s and early 1980s were a high point in British left thinking about the British economy. Mm-hmm. So the were plans developed based on this left critique with which we started our discussion. So the left started to think through how one would have a seriously productionist politics post-Thatcher. So they were looking, for example, to come out of the EEC, looking to control overseas investment, I mean investment going out from the UK, looking to control private enterprises to make them operate in the national interest. Now, what this left argument forgot was that something like this politics and economics had existed in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. There had never been theorized by the left. So there was a move to creating a new, if you like, social democratic political economy at that time, which needs to be recognized. And Neil Kinnock's Labour Party was formally committed to key elements of that. But you're right that goes. It's not seen as credible by elites, and it ceases to be believed by a sector of the Labour Party, which emerges as New Labour. Now, New Labour presented itself as getting rid of the false ideas of old Labour, which were characterised as tax and spent. That argument did was to shift attention away from the fact that what New Labour really, really did was to utterly eviscerate Labour's productionist programme, and essentially to embrace economic liberalism, economic globalism. That's the really big change introduced by New Labour. New Labour, in fact, then becomes a party of tax and spend, as opposed to a party of intervention. And they do tax and they do spend, especially in the early 21st century. So actually, tax and spend is the policy of the Labour right in the 1950s and of New Labour, not the policy of old Labour, which was fundamentally, I think, a national productivist policy. So New Labour does, in my view, represent a really, really transformational change within well, you can't say the left anymore, but within the structures of the Labour Party. As far as I'm concerned, as far as this book is concerned, the last Labour government left office in 1979.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that makes more sense. Ultimately, I think that view is probably a bit more right. David,
Tony Blair was right. I mean, he insisted that New Labour was different from Labour. We will govern as New Labour, he said in 1997, and he did.
Yeah. Well, David, it looks like we're running out of time here. I just wanted to ask you, what are your new projects? What are you working on now?
Well, I've got some bits and pieces, a paper on ideology and history in relation to how the Second World War is understood in Britain. I've got a paper coming out on war and welfare state in 20th century Britain. And I'm looking forward to thinking about production, the productive forces in world history in the 20th century. So I'm looking to develop a new big project, but also certainly to continue to think and write about 20th century British history too.